Argument this afternoon, the first is People versus Tony. Council President, ready? All right, if you go ahead and have a seat, we'll hear your case first. And the second case is Weevil et al. Versus Darrow et al. Council President, ready?
We're ready, Your Honor.
All right, we'll take that case second. For those of you who have not argued here before, let me briefly explain the ground rules. Excuse me, these cases are set for 15 minutes per side. You'll be guided by a lighting system on the podium, which works as follows. When your time begins, the green light comes on. When 10 minutes have expired, the amber light comes on. And when your full 15 minutes have expired, the red light comes on. You'll be guided by the timing system because it counts backwards from 15, so you'll know how much time you have left. You may save, the appellant may say whatever part of the 15 minutes you wish for rebuttal. If you want me to give you some kind of time heads up, I can do that. We've read the briefs in your cases. We're familiar with the facts as you've set them forth, so to the extent you want to skip a recitation of the facts and proceed directly to your legal argument, that's fine with us. But the case is yours to argue as you wish. We would ask you to stay close to the podium because we're recording your arguments, and we occasionally like to go back and listen to them again. And if you stray from the podium, the microphone will not pick up your voice well. Please also be advised that the arguments are available over the internet within several days following today's date. So if there's any information that you wish to keep confidential, please be guided by that warning. Finally, if anybody in the audience has a cell phone or a pager or some other kind of electronic device that is capable of beeping, please turn it off at this point. We're ready for argument in People versus Tony.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Cynthia Mardian. I'm here for the appellant in this case, Sean Tony. Mr. Tony was the defendant in the case below. I'll start my argument by addressing the first issue that I raised in the opening brief, which is the issue regarding the question of the juror, and then I'll move on to the other argument. Your Honor, I'm sure you've gone through the brief, so you know, but I'll just repeat it. The question that the juror submitted to the court was, I don't agree that the defendant is guilty on one of the charges and the rest of the jury feels otherwise. Do I have to give in and find him guilty so everyone can stop badgering me, or do I have to convince 11 people to feel the same as I do? The response of the court, the trial judge, was to say, please submit any questions by having your four-person write out and then sign the question. Thank you for your cooperation. And, Your Honor, I think it's been the law in Colorado for many, many years that a trial judge should not in any way coerce a juror into making a decision in a case. In my opening brief, I cited three cases, the Lowe case, which is a 1971 case, the Lewis case, which is a 1984 case, and the Dahl case, which is a 2007 case. Each of those cases uses different language to talk about this type of coercion, but they all just basically state the same thing.
Excuse me, Ms. Mardian. Is Mardian correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where is the coercion in the statement that the questions need to be submitted through the foreperson? How is that coercive?
Your Honor, first of all, the jury was not advised of that. There is an instruction that's available. It was not given in this case. So that particular
was not advised of what?
That the foreperson was the one who needed to submit any questions.
Okay, but isn't that what the judge responded after this juror asked a question?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
And where's the coercion in that?
Okay, Your Honor, the juror here, I mean, clearly the juror, just from the way he framed the question, or she framed this question, this jury, it was 1 to 11. This juror was clearly feeling that the rest of the jury was badgering him. The juror was going to the court for advice on how to deal with the situation. The juror was totally shut down. The response was, I'm not going to help you at all. This isn't my problem. If the foreperson could have submitted that question, they could have submitted the question, but it was 11 to 1. this apparently was not the foreperson. The next question was, I would suspect, was from a different person, which was signed by the foreperson. So the initial question was not the foreperson. So you're putting that person in a position of not being able to express anything to the judge. I'm not going to listen to you. That
so,
was
effective. So as I understand it, then, what you're looking at is, I mean, the case law is clear. The court cannot coerce. And certainly the modified Allen instruction has specific language where the court has to advise that no one should vote against their own conscience. Here the court simply says, as I understand your argument, the court was non-responsive. And is that what your argument is? Is that the court, by being non-responsive, was in effect coercing, and that is contrary to existing case law? Or is your argument that this is really a something new and we ought to address it as something new?
No, I don't believe this is really something new.
Okay.
I think under the existing case law, I think the most recent case was the Dahl case, which was a 2007 case. And what the language in that case was that it, you know, affected the jury's ability or inclination to participate fully in the deliberative process. How was this juror supposed to participate fully in the deliberative process when it was 11-1? He asked for, or she asked for, assistance from the judge, and that wasn't given.
Well, what prevented the juror from restating the question, asking the jury foreperson to sign it, and sending it back to the court?
Your Honor, I don't know if the juror was in that position to do that. Perhaps the next question from the jury foreperson was specifically, can we get the alternate juror? Which I would take to mean that the rest of the jury was not happy with the one juror. So, you know, maybe they asked that to happen, and maybe it didn't happen. Maybe the foreperson refused to do that.
Is it your view that the court should have given a modified Allen instruction under these circumstances?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that would have been necessary. Your Honor, and I think one of the issues raised by the people in their answer brief was that this was not, that the jury here was not necessarily deadlocked. And I don't think whether the jury was deadlocked or not is really necessary to the analysis here. You know, from reading it, it looks like they may have been deadlocked. This jury was out for a very short period of time, well, certainly less than one day. The record itself doesn't say when these questions came or how long the jury was actually out, but it was certainly less than a day. So we don't know if the juror was, if it was deadlocked or not, so I don't know that the Allen instruction would have been an appropriate response.
What difference does it make, Ms. Mardian, that counsel specifically agreed to this approach in the trial court? Defense counsel.
Your Honor, I think what the record says is that he didn't object to it. The actual conference, where the phone conference where they discussed this, was not recorded, so we don't know exactly.
Was it constructed afterwards, though?
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah, there were, in both of the questions the judge just took, had a phone conference between the two attorneys and the judge himself. And then when they went back on the record, when the jury came back with its verdict, then they reconstructed that. So we don't know exactly what happened during the course, you know, the course of that conversation, the telephone conversation. The defense counsel agreed that he did not object to it. Whether he was actively agreed to it are two entirely different things.
Well, what is the trial court supposed to do? If he doesn't object, he says, this is the answer I'm going to give the jurors, and he doesn't object, it seems like there's no preservation of the alleged error, is there? And then we have to go by a plain error analysis. And we have to find that this was a coercive language to tell them that the foreman should submit the questions.
Okay. Well, I would go back to the Dahl case to answer your question. In that case, the judge had actually had, excuse me, I think I'm telling you the wrong case. Okay, in the case where the judge had told the juror that he would put them in contempt because the juror had come back to court late, and it was the Dahl case.
Yeah.
In that case, I don't know that there were objections from counsel. I think there was an objection, but Your Honor, it's
There was a motion for mistrial, and so that would preserve something. But the concern here, Ms. Mardian, I think, is that, well, what's the standard of review in your view?
Your Honor, I think it would need to be harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt. And the people have argued that this was invited error because the defense counsel did not initially object, which would make it plain error. I don't believe it is invited error under the, I believe it was the Rogers case. They talked about what was necessary for invited error. And the defense counsel would have needed to actively have agreed with that response.
Okay, but then on the other hand, in order to have the full benefit of the constitutional harmless error, wouldn't counsel have needed to object? I mean, without an objection, aren't we in a plain error mode?
He did object. He objected perhaps late. But he did make an objection that he was unable to find any case law that supported the response of the judge that the question needed to come from the jury
for the objection has to be made in time for the trial court to do something with it. This all happens after the fact when counsel makes the objection. The trial court's already taken the action, at least in partial reliance upon what counsel told him they agreed to or didn't object to. So how is making the objection when the jury's signaling they've got a verdict preserving the issue? The court couldn't do anything about it at that point, could it?
No, I would agree with that, Your Honor. The court could not.
And I think, Ms. Mardian, the other problem you're going to have is that even then, to object on the grounds that there's nothing requiring it to come through the jury form and still is not an objection that there's a constitutional mandate here and that there's a constitutional right. So you still have a preservation problem on that. But go ahead.
Okay. Well, I'll address then the plain error issue. Even if this is plain error, a reviewing court can't really speculate as to what the jury would have done. And that's not the role of a reviewing court. If, in fact, this juror had been given an appropriate response, which I would say was what was in the Grace case, you should continue to deliberate to see if you can resolve the issues. I believe that would have been a more appropriate response. It would have not, the judge would not have needed to find if the jury was deadlocked to do that, and it would have given some encouragement of this to this juror to continue to deliberate.
And the instruction that you would say, I mean, you're saying not necessarily a modified Allen, but what would have been the response of the court then that the court should have done?
Well, I believe the People versus Grace is the best response. I did go through a few cases of the Ragland case, the Grace case, and the Allen case.
Isn't that what they did? Didn't they continue to deliberate? How would the instruction have told them to do anything other than what they did?
I think what the instruction told the juror who wrote the question was that the court really wasn't concerned about what they had to say or what their position was. It did not encourage that juror to continue with the position that he believed that Mr. Tony wasn't guilty of one of those charges. It didn't encourage that juror to continue that position. It encouraged that juror that I'm not going to help you out here. You're stuck with these 11 people badgering you. I would request that I be allowed to keep the remaining few minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is John Seidel, number 17633, representing the people. I want to begin with the standard of review, and I guess in my view it looks like we're going to be discussing the first issue. Since counsel didn't address the other ones, I think she would be limited to this issue and the rebuttal. As we said in the brief, I think the standard is invited error. And I cited you the Hendrickson case. I don't want to go through the facts of that unless there's some questions about it. But I do want to say that this case virtually parallels Hendrickson, in that in both cases, the defense counsel agreed to the trial court's response, which in both cases was a proposed response was, let's tell the jury how we want them to ask questions. And Hendrickson, that note, a note like that, and two others, the court said, a division of this court said, we're not going to review those because defense counsel agreed to the responses. Now, it was mentioned in the reply brief, and I think Your Honor, Judge Casebolt brought it up today, that, well, maybe the defense just simply didn't object to the trial court's proposal. Well, my reading of the discussion of the jury question section of the record, which we refer to as DJQ, the court summarized what had just happened right after the jury had come back or announced that it had verdicts. And the court basically said, well, here's what happened. We got this note. We had a conference with counsel, a telephone conference with both counsel. And I'm going to get to whether or not, and I propose, the judge is speaking, and the judge said, I propose that we tell the jury how to ask questions, and I'll get to whether or not the parties agreed with that in a moment. Then it went said something else, and then it finally said, neither side objected to that, my proposal, and that's what was done. Have I summarized the record correctly? And both sides said, basically, yes, that's right. It seems to me that what happened there then, a fair reading, really the only fair reading, is that defense counsel had to have made an affirmative statement to the court over the telephone, judge, I don't have any problem with that. Judge, that's the same thing as saying, judge, I agree to that. I guess what I'm saying is that an affirmative statement that you're okay with the trial court's proposal is the same thing as an agreement to it. And it's the same thing whether you say, I don't object to that, or I agree with that. It's the same thing. In fact, the trial court itself characterized defense counsel's position as both agreeing with the trial court and not objecting to it.
Does it have to be, to be invited error, do we have to conclude that it was a strategic choice?
Oh boy, Your Honor, that's a kilt I'd rather not lift, but I've got it's one of my hobby horses, and to answer the question briefly, I think that to the idea that this court as an appellate body would have to make a fact finding that this was a strategic choice violates several rules, one of which is that this court isn't a fact-finding body. Secondly, the real fact-finding bodies in these matters are is the trial court, and it's always done, or virtually always done, in a post-conviction motion for ineffective assistance of counsel. Cases have said over and over again, on direct appeal, we are not going to hear these cases because 9 times out of 10 or more, we need to develop a record. Well, if that's the case for ineffective assistance of counsel, why is it that we're going to make the prosecution, who's making an invited error argument, why are we going to make them show that an error is not strategic or is strategic to an appellate body? I think this whole notion that it's got to be a strategic choice really flies in the face of those two rules, and also essentially has led courts astray from the original basis for invited error, which was the party must be bound by its actions below. It's an equitable principle. It had nothing to do with strategic choices.
Do you think we're bound by the reference to that in the Stewart case? I mean, do we regardless of whether it's a good idea or not,
I think it would be fair to say this is what Stewart said. This is why we don't think it was a good choice. However, I think you can go on and say, in this case, the choice was strategic, or appeared to be, even though we're not really authorized to make a fact-finding on that point. Okay. If this court were authorized to make a fact-finding, I think it could say, look, you have defense counsel here who has a phone conversation.
Excuse me, Matt, I don't want to take up your time on this issue. I wanted to address it because it's in the Stewart case. I think you've answered my question. You can go on.
Okay. I'd gladly do that. Having said all that, I'd like to move on to the alternative standard of review. which is plain error. I mean, the cases have made clear, Stewart has made clear, if it's not invited error, which precludes review, then we review it under plain error. And I think the panel's made some good observations that sort of get the ball rolling. First of all, there was no objection at all, much less on constitutional grounds. I think, as Your Honor Caporelli pointed out, there, in order to preserve a constitutional claim and some constitutional standard review, there would have to be objections on those grounds, and there wasn't. And there is no constitutional right to a certain trial court action given this exact note that we have here. There was another point made, I think, by Your Honor Richmond, which was that the objection that was made came too late. It was after the verdicts were reached, and I think the opposing counsel agreed with that. So we're in plain error land, and the standard is whether or not any error was obvious in the sense of being easily perceived, and whether it had on a deadlock now or had effect on the outcome. Now, I think we have to remember that a trial court's response to a note like this is discretionary. It's reviewed for abuse of discretion. And a trial court also has discretion on how it's going to have communications with the jury. So what we're reviewing here is whether there was an obvious, a blatant abuse of discretion. That's where you have to be to find to reverse on this issue. Now, there's been some discussion about whether there was really a deadlock or not. Well, you know, my response is, look, the only case law we have really is, what do judges do when they get notes or communications from a jury suggesting that there is some kind of conflict between members of the jury? Okay, all of those notes, as far as I can see, fall under the rubric of deadlock cases, and which puts us into this notion of, into the area of discretionary calls. And one of the discretionary calls is, was there a deadlock? What do I, as a trial judge, have to do given this note? In my opinion, and I think we've made the point in the brief, there was no obvious, blatant abuse of discretion. Okay, the note did not say, we cannot agree, we never will agree, no matter come hell or high water.
Well, even if the two notes taken together lead to the inference that there's a deadlock, and I'm talking about the second note as well, mm-hmm. Give us an alternate back. Is the judge under any obligation to then give the modified Allen instruction, sua sponte? It wasn't asked for here, was it?
It was not, and that's one of the points I wanted to make. Even after the second note, defense counsel agrees that the proper response is to tell the jury, no, you don't get the alternate. Now, in my mind, if the counsel had said, this is defense counsel, had said, look, judge, I think we may have a problem here. We may have a deadlock. I think the judge at that point might well have said, been within its discretion to say, I think we at least had better make an inquiry. But when trial counsel does not say that, and the note itself, neither note, or in combination, they do not expressly say we are deadlocked. Mm-hmm. And the court here looks at the second note and says, you know, these guys maybe they're just frustrated with this one person, but they don't say we just can't agree. I mean, the second note doesn't say we want the alternate juror because this other person is being obstinate or refuses to deliberate. They just say we want the second juror. And the trial court says, you know, this may be half in jest. Now, I guess getting back to my original point then, I mean, to answer the question, I think had circumstances been different, I think it would have been the right thing to do to ask what the jury's up to, but not where counsel basically doesn't argue a deadlock. And furthermore, although the trial court would have been within its discretion to inquire, I think that given the length of the trial, less than 2 days, in the relative simplicity of the issues, and the fact that the notes didn't suggest a deadlock so much as they did just suggest mutual frustration between two factions of the jury, I think that the trial court would not have been required to inquire, even had counsel broached the issue. But the bottom line is that the trial court The trial court's response to the first note, which is the issue we're here on, was not, it was not a gross abuse of discretion to simply opt to wait for a statement from the foreman that the jury as a collective whole was deadlocked, could not agree, was stuck.
Do you agree that there was no stock instruction given to the jury that the foreman should submit all questions? The first time I heard
I that. I do agree with
they
that.
They admitted that. So the judge was basically just filling in that gap when he gave this the question?
Excuse me. I think that's right. In fact, when the judge was summarizing what had happened, I think he explained that he thought the better practice was for these questions to come through the foreman. And I think that's right. And the one point I did want to make today was that if we were to reverse on this case, on these facts, you would be saying it is all right for any juror who's frustrated with the process, feels badgered, feels like they're on the losing side or as an underdog, or just feels like it's too hard to make their point or to win the day, it's okay for that person to send a note to the judge and stop the process. It doesn't have to say that the jury's deadlocked. It doesn't have to say anything about it doesn't have to say anything about coercion. All it has to do is say, I'm done with this. And the note goes to the trial court, and without any of the other jurors' agreement or input, the judge has to say, okay, this is a potential for coercion. It seems to me that that claim is contrary to what the rules of appellate review are. That claim is entirely speculative. There's no evidence here of coercion. The claim is simply, well, I had a frustrated juror, they sent a note, and they didn't get immediate halt to deliberations. Now, the question could be asked, and in fact it was brought up, well, you know, what effect did this have on the juror? And I think the panel made very good points about this. Defense counsel says, I wish the court would have given the instruction in grace, please keep deliberating. How's that different from what actually happened? It wasn't. And furthermore, when the court sends back a response that says, please submit questions through the foreman, I disagree with opposing counsel that this shut the juror down. It seems to me that that told the juror, you will be heard if you simply follow this simple procedure. Send your question through the foreman. Now, is it possible that a foreman would not submit a question like that to the judge? I think it's possible. But do we have any evidence of it here? Absolutely not. And to think that that is what happened, that means their claim entirely rests on speculation. And I might say that that speculation that a foreman would deliberately refuse to submit a question or a comment by a juror that they feel badgered, that's really far-fetched speculation.
I know you have very little time left, but would you turn your attention just briefly to the jury instruction on vehicular eluding? I'll tell you the truth, we're a bit confused about what happened there. As you seem to be.
If I can, I would like to say, give some facts about who was taking what position. Would that answer your question?
Or?
Originally, what happened was there were these instructions. I don't know who tendered them. They defined recklessness for the vehicular eluding under the criminal code, exactly what they want. They defined reckless driving under the traffic code, and both were elements of different offenses. Prosecution says, this is a mess, but I think we have to do it this way. Trial court says, I think we should define in a reckless manner for purposes of the eluding statute consistent with the traffic code, and the defense basically agrees.
Okay. What are they talking about when he says he wants to strike two sentences from a particular instruction?
To be honest, Your Honor, I'm not sure I know, because we don't have, as far as I know, we don't have the
proposed
instruction that has the stuff stricken out.
Okay.
Thank you for your time.
I would just like to discuss the issue of just speculation. I think I'm not asking the court to speculate. And in Dahl, it specifically says that a reviewing court cannot speculate as to whether there was conversion or coercion. We don't know what happened in the jury room. And we also don't know what happened in the conference call between the judge and the two attorneys. And anything we talk about there would be pure speculation. So I'm not asking you to speculate. This was not invited error, and I would refer you to, in my reply brief, I discuss the Rogers case, and there is a quote from the Rogers case, the Rivers case, and it says, active participation in the preparation of a response to a jury question or express agreement with it bars the participant from arguing that the response constitutes error. We don't know if that happened. We don't know what happened at that conversation. All we know is that the defense counsel later said that he did not object to it. And it's easy to sit back as a reviewing court and say, well, if he didn't object, that meant he agreed. If you're actually in a trial and you're before the judge, just because you're not strongly objecting doesn't mean that you're agreeing. It may be that you're not taking a position, that you don't really know the answer, you're not taking a position. It could mean lots of different things, but it doesn't mean that you're actively participating in the decision to give that response. So this is simply, it's not invited error. If you want to get into plain error, and I've cited the Bockhoffer case in my reply brief, and it talks about plain error within the context of instructional error, but it says that there needs to be a reasonable possibility that the error contributed to the conviction. Here, I would argue that there is a reasonable possibility that this error contributed to conviction. This juror was saying that there is one issue, or there is one charge that I don't agree on. We don't know which one it was, but there was this one charge I don't agree on. If this juror was shut down by that and chose not to continue to participate in the jury deliberations because of the response to the judge, then I think there is a reasonable possibility that that error contributed to the conviction here.
But the premise of that first has to be that the judge erred, that the judge had some obligation, that the law says that the judge was required to do something other than what he did, she did?
He did.
Mm-hmm. In other words, I mean, to say that there was an effect on the outcome, there must have been an error in the first instance.
Yes, Your Honor. I think the trial judge had the obligation to respond to that question in a manner that was not in any way coercive to the juror.
So then it would be, in your view, an abuse of discretion not to have responded in a way other than what he did?
Yes, Your Honor.
Go ahead. Take a little more time. I interrupted you there.
Your Honor, actually, I think I had finished my thoughts.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you both. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course. As soon as counsel can be set up and ready to